Chapter 12. It did not occur to her to turn back over leaf to look. She would have found it recorded there that between 4 and 6 a.m. on December 25th, Captain McWhirr did actually think that his ship could not possibly live another hour in such a sea, and that he would never see his wife and children again. Nobody was to know this. His letters got mislaid so quickly, nobody whatever but the steward, who had been greatly impressed by that disclosure. So much so, that he tried to give the cook some idea of the narrow squeak we all had by saying solemnly, the old man himself had a damn poor opinion of our chance. How do you know? Asked, contemptuously, the cook, an old soldier. He hasn't told you, maybe? Well, he did give me a hint to that effect, the steward brazened it out. Get along with you. He will be coming to tell me next, jeered the old cook, over his shoulder. Mrs. McWhirr glanced farther, on the alert. Do what's fair. Miserable objects, only three, with a broken leg each, and one. Thought had better keep the matter quiet, hope to have done the fair thing. She let fall her hands. No. There was nothing more about coming home. Must have been merely expressing a pious wish. Mrs. McWhirr's mind was set at ease, and a black marble clock, priced by the local jeweler at Ann Pound, 3/18, 60, had a discreet stealthy tick. The door flew open, and a girl in the long-legged, short-frocked period of existence, flung into the room. A lot of colorless, rather lanky hair was scattered over her shoulders. Seeing her mother, she stood still, and directed her pale prying eyes upon the letter. From father, murmured Mrs. McWhirr. Hat, have you done with your ribbon? The girl put her hands up to her head and pouted. He's well, continued Mrs. McWhirr languidly. At least I think so. He never says. As he had a little laugh. The girl's face expressed a wandering indifference, and Mrs. McWhirr surveyed her with fond pride. Go and get your hat, she said after a while. I'm going out to do some shopping. There is a sale at Linham's. Oh, how jolly, uttered the child, impressively, in unexpectedly grave vibrating tones, and bounded out of the room. It was a fine afternoon, with a gray sky and dry sidewalks. Outside the draper's, Mrs. McWhirr smiled upon a woman in a black mantle of generous proportions armored in jet, and crowned with flowers blooming falsely above a bilious matronly countenance. They broke into a swift little babble of greetings and exclamations both together, very hurried, as if the street were ready to yawn open, and swallow all that pleasure before it could be expressed. Behind them the high glass doors were kept on the swing. People couldn't pass, men stood aside waiting patiently, and Lydia was absorbed in poking the end of her parasol between the stone flags. Mrs. McWhirr talked rapidly. Thank you very much. He's not coming home yet. Of course it's very sad to have him away, but it's such a comfort to know he keeps so well. Mrs. McWhirr drew breath. He climate there agrees with him, she added. Beamingly, as if poor McWhirr had been away touring in China for the sake of his health. Neither was the chief engineer coming home yet. Mr. Rout knew too well the value of a good billet. Solomon says wonders will never cease, cried Mrs. Rout joyously at the old lady in her armchair by the fire. Mr. Rout's mother moved slightly, her withered hands lying in black half mittens on her lap. The eyes of the engineer's wife fairly danced on the paper. That captain of the ship, he is in a rather simple man, you remember, mother, has done something rather clever, Solomon says. Yes, my dear, said the old woman meekly, sitting with bowed silvery head, and that air of inward stillness characteristic of very old people who seem lost in watching the last flickers of life. Think I remember. Solomon Rout, old soul, father soul, the chief, Rout, good man Mr. Rout, the condescending and paternal friend of youth, had been the baby of her many children all dead by this time. And she remembered him best as a boy of 10 long, before he went away, to serve his apprenticeship in some great engineering works in the north. S. He had seen so little of him since, S. He had gone through so many years, that S. He had now, to retrace her steps very far back, to recognize him plainly in the midst of time. Sometimes it seemed that her daughter-in-law was talking of some strange man. Mrs. Rout Jr. was disappointed. H'M. She turned the page. How provoking. He doesn't say what it is. Says I couldn't understand how much there was in it. Fancy. What could it be so very clever? What a wretched man not to tell us. She read on without further remark soberly, and at last sat looking into the fire. The chief wrote just a word or two of the typhoon, but something had moved him to express an increased longing for the companionship of the jolly woman. If it hadn't been that mother must be looked after, I would send you your passage money today. You could set up a small house out here. I would have a chance to see you sometimes then. We are not growing younger. He's well, mother, sighed Mrs. Rout, rousing herself. He always was a strong, healthy boy, said the old woman, placidly. But Mr. Jukes' account was really animated and very full. His friend in the Western Ocean trade imparted it freely to the other officers of his liner. Chap I know writes to me about an extraordinary affair that happened on board his ship in that typhoon you know that we read of in the papers 2 months ago. It's the funniest thing. Just see for yourself what he says. I'll show you his letter. There were phrases in it calculated to give the impression of light-hearted, indomitable resolution. Jukes had written them in good faith, for he felt thus when he wrote. He described with lurid effect the scenes in the tween deck. It struck me in a flash that those confounded Chinamen couldn't tell we weren't a desperate kind of robbers. Tisn't good to part the Chinaman from his money if he is the stronger party. We need have been desperate indeed to go thieving in such weather, but what could these beggars know of us? So, without thinking of it twice, I got the hands away in a jiffy. Our work was done that the old man had set his heart on. We cleared out without staying to inquire how they felt. I am convinced that if they had not been so unmercifully shaken, and afraid each individual one of them to stand up, we would have been torn to pieces. Oh, it was pretty complete, I can tell you, and you may run to and fro across the pond to the end of time before you find yourself with such a job on your hands. After this he alluded professionally to the damage done to the ship, and went on thus. It was when the weather quieted down that the situation became confoundedly delicate. It wasn't made any better by us having been lately transferred to the Siamese flag, though the skipper can't see that it makes any difference, as long as we are on board, he says. There are feelings that this man simply hasn't got, and there's an end of it. You might just as well try to make a bedpost understand. But apart from this, it is an infernally lonely state for a ship to be going about the China Seas with no proper consuls, not even a gunboat of her own anywhere, nor a body to go to in case of some trouble. My notion was to keep these Johnnies under hatches for another 15 hours or so, as we weren't much farther than that from Fuchao. We would find there, most likely, some sort of a man of war, and once under her guns we were safe enough, for surely any skipper of a man of war English, French or Dutch would see white men through as far as row on board goes. We could get rid of them, and their money afterwards, by delivering them to their mandarin or tatai, or whatever they call these chaps in goggles you see, being carried about in sedan chairs through their stinking streets. The old man wouldn't see it somehow. He wanted to keep the matter quiet. He got that notion into his head, and a steam windlass couldn't drag it out of him. He wanted as little fuss made as possible, for the sake of the ship's name, and for the sake of the owners, for the sake of all concerned, says he, looking at me very hard. It made me angry hot. Of course you couldn't keep a thing like that quiet. But the chests had been secured in the usual manner, and were safe enough for any earthly gale, while this had been an altogether fiendish business I couldn't give you even an idea of. Meantime, I could hardly keep on my feet. None of us had a spell of any sort for nearly 30 hours, and there the old man sat rubbing his chin, rubbing the top of his head, and so bothered he didn't even think of pulling his long boots off. I hope, sir, apostrophe says I, you won't be letting them out on deck before we make ready for them in some shape or other. Apostrophe apostrophe not, mind you, that I felt very sanguine about controlling these beggars, if they meant to take charge. A trouble with a cargo of Chinamen is no child's play. I was damn tired too. I wish, apostrophe said I, you would let us throw the whole lot of these dollars down to them, and leave them to fight it out amongst themselves, while we get a rest. Apostrophe apostrophe, now you talk wild. Jukes, apostrophe says he, looking up in his slow way, that makes you ache all over, somehow. We must plan out something that would be fair to all parties. Apostrophe apostrophe, I had no end of work on hand, as you may imagine, so I set the hands going, and then I thought I would turn in a bit. I hadn't been asleep in my bunk 10 minutes, when in rushes the steward, and begins to pull at my leg. For God's sake, Mr. Jukes. Come out. Come on deck quick, sir. Oh, do come out. Apostrophe apostrophe, the fellow scared all the sense out of me. I didn't know what had happened. Another hurricane, or what? Could hear no wind. The captain's letting them out. Oh, he is letting them out. Jump on deck, sir, and save us. The chief engineer has just run below for his revolver. Apostrophe apostrophe, that's what I understood the fool to say. However, father out swears he went in there, only to get a clean pocket handkerchief. Anyhow, I made one jump into my trousers, and flew on deck aft. There was certainly a good deal of noise going on forward of the bridge. Four of the hands with the bosun were at work abaft. I passed up to them some of the rifles all the ships on the China coast carry in the cabin, and let them on the bridge. On the way I ran against Old Soul, looking startled and sucking at an unlighted cigar. Come along, apostrophe I shouted to him. We charged, the seven of us, up to the chart room. All was over. There stood the old man with his sea boots still drawn up to the hips and in shirt sleeves, got warm thinking it out, I suppose. Bunhin's dandy clerk at his elbow, as dirty as a sweep, was still green in the face. I could see directly I was in for something. What the devil are these monkey tricks, Mr. Jukes? Apostrophe apostrophe asks the old man, as angry as ever he could be. I tell you frankly, it made me lose my tongue. For God's sake, Mr. Jukes, apostrophe says he, do take away these rifles from the men. Somebody's sure to get hurt before long if you don't. Damn, if this ship isn't worse than Bedlam. Look sharp now. I want you up here to help me, and Bunhin's Chinaman to count that money. You wouldn't mind lending a hand to Mr. Rout, now you are here. The more of us the better. Apostrophe apostrophe, he had settled it all in his mind, while I was having a snooze. Had we been an English ship, or only going to land our cargo of coolies in an English port, like Hong Kong, for instance, there would have been no end of inquiries and bother, claims for damages and so on. But these Chinamen know their officials better than we do. The hatches had been taken off already, and they were all on deck after a night and a day down below. It made you feel queer to see so many gaunt wild faces together. The beggars stared about at the sky, at the sea, at the ship, as though they had expected the whole thing to have been blown to pieces. And no wonder. They had had a doing that would have shaken the soul out of a white man. But then they say a Chinaman has no soul. He has, though, something about him that is too tough. There was a fellow amongst others of the badly hurt, who had his eye all but knocked out. It stood out of his head the size of half a hen's egg. This would have laid out a white man on his back for a month. And yet there was that chap elbowing here and there in the crowd and talking to the others, as if nothing had been the matter. They made a great hubbub amongst themselves, and whenever the old man showed his bald head on the foreside of the bridge, they would all leave off jawing and look at him from below. It seems that, after he had done his thinking, he made that bun-hin's fellow go down, and explain to them the only way they could get their money back. He told me afterwards that, all the coolies having worked in the same place and for the same length of time, he reckoned he would be doing the fair thing by them, as near as possible if he shared all the cash we had picked up equally among the lot. You couldn't tell one man's dollars from another's, he said, and if you asked each man how much money he brought on board, he was afraid they would lie, and he would find himself a long way short. I think he was right there. As to giving up the money to any Chinese official he could scare up in Fuchao, he said he might just as well put the lot in his own pocket at once for all the good it would be to them. I suppose they thought so too. We finished the distribution before dark. It was rather a sight. The sea running high, the ship a wreck to look at, these Chinamen staggering up on the bridge one by one for their share, and the old man still booted, and in his shirt sleeves, busy paying out at the chart room door, perspiring like anything, and now and then coming down sharp on myself, or father out about one thing, or another not quite to his mind. He took the share of those who were disabled himself to them on the number two hatch. There were $3 left over, and these went to the three most damaged coolies, one to each. We turned to afterwards, and shoveled out on deck heaps of wet rags, all sorts of fragments of things without shape, and that you couldn't give a name to, and let them settle the ownership themselves. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.